From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Happy Darwin Day. February 12th was Charles Darwin's birthday. He would be a venerable 209 this year. In The Descent of Man, Darwin wrote, "Ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge. It is those who know little, not those who know much, who so positively assert that this or that problem will never be solved by science." Well, with that in mind, here's a problem that scientists are working to solve right now and we'll be talking about this hour. North Atlantic right whales are in danger of going extinct in the next few decades. Entanglement in fishing gear is the leading cause of death. Many are looking for a technological fix that would eliminate the need for vertical ropes in the water. Also, forensic science has become a mainstay of our legal system, but a new investigation finds that much of it may not be scientific at all. First things first, though, SpaceX's first launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket was largely successful, and Elon Musk's cherry red Tesla Roadster is now floating through space. Well, just where is it headed? Does it even matter? Joining me now is Jason Davis. He's digital editor for the Planetary Society. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
The headline here, clearly, is that SpaceX launched the most powerful rocket since Saturn V, landed two of the three boosters, did all of this for a fraction of the cost of what previous launches have cost, right? But then there's this Tesla Roadster floating through space with a soundtrack and live feed that's really captured the public attention. Some people love it, some people hate it, and you were kind of hesitant to even wade in on this issue. What pushed you over the edge?
Well, you know, sometimes when I write about space so much, I really get into the weeds and I don't see the bigger picture and what the public is thinking about all this. And I talked with a friend who's just kind of, you know, he thinks space is cool and he likes checking in, but he isn't necessarily plugged in the way I am. And he told me he didn't like the car. And I was like, I think this is a bigger story that's, you know, escaping the space community at this point, and it's worth talking about.
So why didn't he like the car? What are the objections?
So his objection was that he didn't like it from an artistic standpoint. So so he was not as impressed as some people are of this, you know, these cool views of a car and a mannequin in a spacesuit and it floating through space with Earth in the background. And so, you know, art is subjective. Not everybody likes the car. But, you know, it also goes a little bit beyond that. A lot of people have pointed out that the aerospace industry is very heavily male-oriented. It's particularly white men. And a lot of people kind of saw this as a grandiose gesture by somebody that was kind of speaking unilaterally for Earth. And if they didn't like it, they felt like they had no say in the matter. You know, typically, this is the purview of government agencies that do these types of things. But now we've reached the point where just individuals can launch things into space, and then they're kind of speaking for Earth. So it raises a lot of interesting sociological questions.
Definitely raises those questions. At the same time, it raises the question of what's the option? I mean, most of these test payloads are like a chunk of concrete or something, you know, basically just, yeah. You know, really meaningless space trash. I mean, would that have been a better option? Is there any better option?
You know, yes, concrete was one option, although not nearly as aesthetically pleasing. You know, some people argued that SpaceX could have asked for satellites, like if anybody wanted to gamble their satellite on this mission, because it was a risky flight all in all. Elon Musk was kind of, he felt 50-50 about whether or not it would succeed. So, you know, if anybody had a satellite that they wanted to risk and were willing to take that risk, they could have done that. In SpaceX's defense, you know, it's not a trivial matter to integrate satellites to a space, to a rocket and make sure they separate properly and all those things. So, you know, this is a test flight. They may not have wanted to deal with that. Other people were arguing that we have the sheer cost of the car. I mean, this is like a $200,000 sports car. You could have auctioned that, you know, and gave the money to charity. And there were a lot of other options along that line of thinking.
Elon Musk has made some claims about where the Roadster is headed, where in space, where in our solar system, that those claims don't necessarily add up, though, when you talk to engineers. Do we know where the Roadster is headed?
Yeah, so before the flight, we had very little information, just basically a couple tweets by Elon Musk. Basically, they just launched it away from Earth, and kind of the generally accepted theory is they burned the rocket, you know, until it ran out of fuel and just decided to see what orbit they could get it into. He said it was headed in the direction of Mars. So, you know, Mars is about 50% farther away from the sun than the Earth is, and the theory was it would go out to Mars orbit, but at some point it's going to start kind of falling back towards the sun because it's going to be orbiting the sun just the way we are on Earth and the way Mars is. So it's kind of its own tiny little planet out there. You know, we talked to engineers about whether or not it might hit Mars, what the chances are that it would last for a billion years. This is something Elon Musk has said. And we got a lot of really conflicting answers back, and it seemed like a lot of people just didn't know. Now, NASA has actually issued some orbital parameters for this, and they are tracking it, or at least they were tracking it when it flew away from Earth. And it does look like it's kind of on this slow heliocentric, meaning around the sun orbit, that kind of roughly goes between Earth and Mars. And after that, we're going to lose track of it, and we won't ultimately ever know what happens to it.
After looking into all of these aspects of the Roadster debate, where do you come down? What's your takeaway from this?
So I'm conflicted, you know, on a very personal level. I love rockets and I love cars. And when I first saw the Roadster in space with Earth behind it, I mean, my jaw just kind of dropped. I thought it was beautiful and really cool. Now, on the other hand, I'm a little uncomfortable personally with people speaking unilaterally for Earth in the way that Elon Musk just has. No one else really had a say in this. And the fact that we're talking about this after it happened, to me, is slightly problematic. It would have been great to have this discussion before it happened. But this is a private company, and we're no longer doing space the way we used to do with NASA and government agencies, where, you know, it's kind of taxpayer-funded, design by committee almost. So I think a good takeaway for this for me is it's possible to hold conflicting views in your brain, to think it's great on one hand and, you know, to see problems with it on the other hand.
That's Jason Davis. He's digital editor for the Planetary Society, and he joined me via Skype. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
For more on SpaceX's Falcon Heavy launch, we turn to Robert Zubrin, the founder of the Mars Society and president of Pioneer Astronautics, an aerospace R&D company in Lakewood, Colorado. In 1990, he co-authored a paper that changed the way NASA thought about human settlement on Mars. His idea was simple, really. Use the natural resources on Mars to keep humans alive, rather than ship everything there. It made the prospect of sending humans to Mars cheaper, and therefore more likely. But we didn't have a rocket that could reach Mars without breaking the budget. The Falcon Heavy launch may have changed that. Robert Zubrin, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for inviting me on your show.
You have pointed out that 7 years ago, a commission found that NASA's moon program had to be canceled because building a heavy lift booster would take 12 years and $36 billion, and that was just too much. Now, SpaceX has done that in half the time at a 20th of the cost. How?
Well, they did it by spending money like it was their own, because a lot of it was. And actually, it turns out, less than a 30th of the cost. So the Augustine Commission was way off base. And it has to be said that Musk went to them and told them that he could develop the heavy lift booster for $2.5 billion, and they sneered at him and sent him on his way. And he went and developed it for less than one. And not only that, but it's 3/4 reusable. So in addition to being a heavy lift booster, it's an inexpensive heavy lift booster. It reduces launch costs by a factor of 6 compared to anything on the market right now. And it does enable human missions to the moon and Mars. And I think the country should seize this opportunity with both hands to finally get a space program that's going somewhere.
You mentioned the reusability of the boosters. One of the most innovative things that SpaceX has done is actually buck the conventional wisdom that you can't possibly land a booster back on Earth for reuse. In this case, they didn't make all 3 boosters landing, but 2 out of 3. Pretty impressive.
Yes, indeed. But you see, it's a product both of their ingenuity and their drive, but also the way they're doing business. You see, the problem with the mainstream aerospace industry, and it must be said, military procurement and many other parts of the government right now, is they're operating on what's called a cost-plus model, which means that they make contracts with people and they say, well, you can charge us whatever this cost you to build plus 8%. Well, this gives contractors an incentive to make things as expensive as possible, increasing their overheads. So look at this. Right now, NASA is working on two big human spaceflight programs, the Space Launch System and the Orion crewed vehicle. Both were started in 2004, and neither has flown. There was a test flight of the Orion capsule in 2014, but with no people in it. I mean, this is ridiculous. Now, NASA didn't always operate this way. When we did Apollo, I mean, we were driven, they were driven to get to the moon before the decade was out, and they didn't mess around. And, you know, they issued the contract for the Saturn V in 1962 and flew it in 1967. They didn't take 14 years and counting, because they haven't flown the SLS yet, to develop a heavy lift booster. And they were doing it the first time.
I'm talking with Robert Zubrin, the founder of the Mars Society, about the SpaceX launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket. With NASA working on its spaceflight systems, we also just had the Google Lunar X Prize, which ended without a winner. No one was actually able to make the March deadline for a lunar launch. Is this the new space race? It's not U.S. versus Russia, government versus government, but instead government versus private?
Well, I have to say the government is not putting up much of a race here. Now, that's not to say that NASA is without accomplishments. In particular, the science programs like sending the rovers to Mars and the probes to Saturn, and the space astronomy programs like Hubble and Kepler have achieved great things, albeit at significant costs. Still, 20 years from now, no one's going to be worried about the cost, but the contributions to science of these missions will be immortal. But the human spaceflight program has accomplished very little since Apollo, because it hasn't been mission-driven. Now, the real competition to SpaceX at this point is coming from another entrepreneurial company, which is called Blue Origin, where the chief investor is Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon.com. And so we're going to see a space race between entrepreneurs, because what Musk has done here is not just shown that he could build various systems that do X, Y, and Z. He's shown that private space launch companies are possible, and there's going to be a lot more SpaceXs, as it were, competing with him. There'll be a Russian SpaceX. There'll be a Chinese SpaceX. There will be European SpaceXs. There'll be additional American SpaceXs. The rush is on right now. And I must say, the other thing about the technology here of reusable first stages is they make possible, as soon as they get a reusable second stage, intercontinental flight, Boston to Sydney in less than an hour. If you have reusable launch vehicles, we're going to see the new space age here, and people will travel from one side of the Earth to the other, traveling through space.
And SpaceX is working with NASA and says they're on track to launch a human crew atop the Falcon Heavy by the end of this year. Do you think that's realistic? And if so, what does that mean for our prospects of a Mars settlement? How close are we to sending people to Mars?
I think we could have humans on Mars in 8 years if we follow through. I mean, if NASA was to say, look, we want to have humans on Mars in 8 years, let's see some fixed price contracts, bids from anyone, and Musk would certainly bid, and Blue Origin would bid, and Lockheed Martin would bid. This would not be, you know, a $400 billion program. It'd be like a $20 billion program. If NASA offered $20 billion fixed price for three human missions to Mars, Musk would bid on that and be laughing all the way to the bank. You know, $20 billion over 10 years is $2 billion a year. It's like 10% of NASA's budget. We could actually have humans on Mars. Instead, they're spending $3 billion a year right now on maintaining the space station, which actually isn't doing anything. Space station is a spaceship that doesn't go anywhere.
Well, it doesn't go anywhere, but is it fair to say it doesn't do anything? They are doing a fair bit of science on the space station.
I would say not that much. I would say the science on the space station is third rate. And some of it is even unethical, which is to say studying the health effects of zero gravity on human subjects when we could avoid the health effects of zero gravity altogether by simply rotating a spacecraft. So that's not right. You know, it's turning astronauts from explorers into guinea pigs. Astronauts should be explorers, not guinea pigs.
That's Robert Zubrin. He's the founder of the Mars Society, which advocates for human settlements on the planet Mars. He joined us via Skype. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Up next, lobstermen and scientists are talking about ways to keep North Atlantic right whales from getting tangled in fishing gear. More on that right after this break.